Hi, Bee Culture listeners. I'm Jim Tew. I'm a columnist for Bee Culture magazine. And I'm reading my article that I've entitled The Honeybee's Winter Nest, Necessary for Surviving the Big Dearth. But before I get started, I guess I want to kind of lead into it some. Over time, beekeepers change their ways, but bees are always the same. They stay exactly the same. During the past few years, some novel issues that are new to beekeepers have been suggested and discussed in the media. For instance, whether or not bee sleep has been addressed and then readdressed. Apparently, they do sleep. If bees feel pain or have other sentient qualities has been topics of other discussions. These unclear bee qualities are still being explored. Even honey is in the bright light of the popular media. Some postulate that bees are not the only animal able to make a honey-like product. I would think somewhat like lab-grown protein, a sweet product, having chemistry akin to that of honey, has been blended with nary a bee in sight. Well, is that honey or not? Topics like this help keep beekeeping interesting and keep our bee knowledge evolving. All of these current discussion topics that I've just listed are beekeeper related. While we humans gnash and pontificate, the bees plod along in their own world, doing their own thing. Their biology is consistently their business, and bees seemingly worry not one whit about their human counterparts. It appears that the beekeeper-bee relationship is totally one-sided. Though topics abound, it would seem to me that our most significant recent advances in understanding our bees has been in the areas of bee biology and related pathogenic subjects. While we know much more about our bees today, we are still far, far from understanding everything about bees. In a real way, much of what bees do in the springtime is in preparation for the next winter season. To survive winter's coldness, bees must find a suitable nest site, construct combs, which are their only nest furnishings. They must gather food and store it. They must maintain a queen presence, maintain worker populations, and swarm to procreate their species. They must defend their nest from interlopers and even defend against their own marauding bee neighbors. Without a protected nest site and suitable stocks of food, a honeybee nest will surely die in the winter season. Bees clearly biologically understand this harsh fact. Their base of operations, the nest, is critical to withstanding the winter season. When searching for a home, bee scouts usually look for a surprisingly small cavity, maybe about 1 cubic foot. For those who care, that's apparently a 0.023 cubic meter. Finer features of a nest home should be that it's dark, it has a defendable entrance, it's dry, and nothing else is living there, such as birds, squirrels, or maybe ants. Ideally, it shouldn't be on the ground or at ground level, which is kind of where a lot of our beehives are located at times. When tearing into trees, early beekeepers were confronted with a morass of bees, comb, brood, and dripping honey. They must have wondered how any rational organization could be seen in such pure chaos. As we now partially understand, the bee nest is a highly structured living environment. Understanding that fundamental structure, so much as is currently possible, can help make all of us better beekeepers. feral nest sizes seem to vary significantly. How quickly, if ever, a colony can fill a cavity varies greatly. Therefore, some wild nests are large and others stay relatively small. Reasons for size variations in nests could be genetics, diseases, pests, and water availability. Certainly, the availability of nectar and pollen resources is critical. Frequently overlooked, simple blind luck is also helpful qualities of a feral colony. For instance, their tree didn't blow down, or they weren't struck by a bee disease, or the season was good. Good luck is always a good characteristic of a successful bee colony. In fact, as humans have altered the general environment, suitable nesting sites have become much dearer to scouting bees, forcing them to accept sites not always perfect for their needs. Occasionally, a swarm is forced to build in the open, which is a fatal nest decision for most nests within temperate parts of the U.S. The natural nest is plainly furnished with wax combs only. Though bees can diligently modify the nest cavity to a degree, for most part they must accept the space as it is. Along the top and sides of the nest, surveyor bees, I named them surveyor bees, will lay out the beginning midribs of combs, and other bees will begin to construct comb along those lines. We don't know how these bees measure the spacing needed when establishing dimensions for future comb. Keenly observant beekeepers long ago discovered that bees require a specific living and working space, or the famous bee space concept. That understanding allowed the subsequent development of artificial domiciles that we have used now for more than 100 years. When bees first occupy a new nest cavity, the first matter of business is to construct worker combs. Besides being an area to nurse developing worker bees, worker-sized comb can also be used to store nectar, pollen, and occasionally a bit of water. To us, as interlopers, new combs seem to be produced almost mystically or magically. The bees will mass together in a group that we call a cluster. This cluster is not a rigid structure, but it's fragile and temporary. As bees hang together in such a cluster, gravitational forces will cause it to hang perpendicular with that influence. In essence, combs are built at right angles with gravity's pull. Later, within the dark hive, this gravitational orientation becomes important in the dance language communication procedure. Four pairs of wax glands on the ventral surface of the bee's abdomens produce snow-white wax flakes. Comb-constructing bees pass a newly produced wax flake forward to their mouths, where the wax is chewed and pulverized. After a short time, the wax particle is molded using the bee's trowel-shaped mandibles into a cylindrical developing cell. It's a communal effort. Other bees may reshape previous efforts before adding their own contribution of wax to the new cell. But finally, a single new cell is produced. But no single bee actually constructs a single cell. It's always a communal project. Experienced beekeepers have seen the completed cells in use near the top of a new frame, while lower on the foundation, shallower cells will still be under construction. Bees build comb only as they need it. New wax melts down to canary yellow color and is valuable for candles and other wax products. It's a beautiful, nicely scented, natural product. Inexperienced beekeepers are frequently disappointed that all the brood chamber space and honey super space is not used by the bees during a particular season. In the old days, beekeeper-supplied wax foundation may even be chewed and mangled by the bees, not even really building comb on it, but just kind of building comb all around it, all over it. It was a mess. If that comb could be cleaned up, it'll be okay, but you kind of wanted those nice straight combs, didn't we? Bees will only construct comb on the impetus of a nectar flow and a comb space shortage. Simply stated, bees must have construction material, nectar, before they can build. Nectar provides that building material, but an unusual building material it is, for it can also be stored as honey rather than reconstituted into wax. Bees will not use stored honey to construct significant amounts of new comb. The experienced beekeeper will provide previously drawn comb for the bees to store honey crops rather than requiring bees to rebuild comb each year. It's costly for the bees to build combs. It's been found that bees must metabolize about 7 to 8 pounds of honey to produce 1 pound of wax, but that 1 pound of building material, beeswax, can build about 35,000 cells in which they can store about 22 pounds of honey. Consequently, their approximate net gain after consuming 8 pounds of honey is 14 pounds of stored honey in reusable comb. It takes about 10,000 bees over a 3-day period to produce 1 pound of wax. That 1 pound will be made up of about 500,000 scales. Comb construction for the beehive is clearly an investment. To me, inexplicably, cappings and other wax particles are not readily reused to any degree, but are allowed to drop to the bottom of the colony, the bottom board, where they either accumulate or are discarded in front of the colony. New wax is soft and pliable and will break easily, but as the comb ages, it becomes reinforced with cocoons and propolis and becomes remarkably strong. Whereas new comb is snow white, isn't it interesting that old comb becomes nearly jet black? Worker comb by far is the most abundant comb cell size within the colony. As I mentioned above, worker size combs, or about 5 cells per inch, can be used by bees to house developing worker bees or to store honey and pollen. Larger cells, at about 4 per inch, are used to produce drone larvae, or alternatively, to store honey and pollen also. But it gets confusing. Distorted cells, or cells of intermediate size, can occur that are used by the bees to splice the combs together. In other words, what I'm trying to say, worker comb will be filled with patches of drone comb with small amounts of transitional combs wherever needed in order to make a piece of solid comb cells. Some cells may be either drastically modified or built purposely for raising queens. As you would expect, this type of modified comb cell, though a distinctive, is not really all that common within combs, only as they need queens. A precursor to queen cells are queen cups, which are simply queen cells that are not in use at the moment. Worker cells, drone cells, queen cells, and transitional cell sizes make up the types of comb cells within typical honeybee colonies. Bees will frequently build brace combs between frames, or above, or below frames, or anywhere on the bottom board, especially after a colony has been recently moved. Anywhere bee space is violated, additional comb may be built that is a nuisance to beekeepers in commercially manufactured hives. Normally, in managed hives, it's scraped off and melted down as high-quality wax. Within wild nests, it remains in place and helps give rigidity to the overall nest. So, bee space, the concept of bee space, I've mentioned it several times, I've talked all around it. Within both wild and managed hives, bee space must be respected. Bee space is generally considered to be anything between 1/4 and 3/8 of an inch. Less than 1/4 of an inch will be filled with propolis, while anything greater than 3/8 of an inch will have either comb or a brace comb built within the space, depending on its size. In our beekeeping literature, the Reverend L.L. Langstroth is generally given credit for conceptualizing and popularizing the notion of bee space. Propolis is little known outside of the inner circles of beekeeping. Produced from resinous materials collected from the buds of trees or from resins from softwoods, propolis is used to caulk the hive tightly. Though stringy and sticky when fresh, propolis dries hard and brittle. It's soluble in alcohol and has a pleasant, weedy odor. Since there's no real difference between the two, both wild and managed bees produce propolis. If you can still find Caucasian strains of bees, they are renowned for collecting copious amounts of propolis, and they would occasionally nearly close the entire colony entrance if left to their own schemes. Propolis is the material that causes the hive to crack sharply when we open it. Propolis was the primary demon that relegated so many hive designs to beekeeping's junk heap. If colonies are not opened for several years, propolis accumulation make the hive very nearly impenetrable. Propolis, along with pollen, darkens wax over a period of just a few years. Additionally, in addition to being used to polish cells, propolis is added to the wax that covers cappings, therefore giving them a different appearance than honey cappings. This gummy product is bacterially active and will restrict bacterial growth, probably due to the antimicrobial characteristics. Propolis is used to entomb anything the bees can't move, such as a dead mouse or a tree branch or wax moth residue. Well, there it is, the dark nest. Inside this dark maze of twisted, bee-spaced combs, the bees live in hot, humid darkness during warm months and cold darkness during winter months. Through the beekeeping years, innovative beekeepers have learned how to take the bees' penchant for building natural comb and have enticed them to build comb within wooden frames, mainly for our human convenience. It's just too difficult to remove cross-comb frames for honey removal, disease inspections, or colony manipulations. Inside the dark, warm nest, bees probably communicate by pheromone perception that I crudely say is just a type of odor. Touch or other sensory perceptions such as gravitational sensitivity and electromagnetism are also important. Nest is incredibly crowded. The bees are literally shoulder to shoulder. Yet all these characteristics vanish, poof, they're gone, when the beekeeper removes the outer cover from the hive and lets in light. All becomes visible, and the normal way of the colony, with the application of smoke to mask the effective communication odors, is disrupted. Within the undisturbed dark hive, everything has a unique odor. Workers, the queen, drones, wax, wax moths, brood pollen, the hunger of larvae, danger. Whether or not the larvae are in correct cells, everything seems to have some kind of cue within the dark hive. I wish I could say this in a different way, but as beekeepers, we just crudely use smoke to mask this elegant communication system. They got to regulate the temperature to about 95 degrees Fahrenheit in this winter nest. Nectar must be enzymatically reduced in warm months, and excess water must be removed from nectar to form the honey. The brood must be freshly fed collected pollen, and this hive city must defend itself from intruders and pests. The society must be kept in balance. In a full-strength colony of about 60,000 reproductive sterile workers, one fertile queen, and about four, maybe up to 600 drones make up the bees inside the colony. Developing brood must be produced in anticipation of upcoming nectar flows or winter season. All of these individuals come together to form the superorganism, the bee nest. Even under ideal conditions, individual bees are incapable of supporting themselves for more than a few weeks. The total bee nest is the animal, not the individual bee. Listeners, such is life and the bee's wintering nest, so much as we currently understand at this moment. It's an intriguing situation to visit another species' lifestyle and see what they want from their environment. I appreciate you listening. Thank you for reading and listening so much. I'm Jim Tew, telling you goodbye for now.